Freddy's not gonna be
go,
here.
Go find. Right. Remember the number.
Thanks for too much.
I'm gonna open the House Interim Committee on Rural Communities. Today's Thursday, January 16th, 2014. And first, I am going to open our informational meeting. And I'm going to ask our colleague, Senator Johnson, to give us a little information from her perspective about House Bill 2620. Then we'll return. There'll be some other folks later from agencies involved to come talk, fill in any additional details and things. But why don't you tell us what you know?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the courtesy. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I had anticipated being here with a cast of characters to support this Legislative Concept 260. Legislative Concept 260 is the work product of several things. It is the work product of a task force that was pulled together by the direction of House Bill 2613 in the 2013 session. It is also an amalgam of one of my drafts for 2014 that has now fallen by the wayside and is incorporated in this effort. So this bill that your committee will be considering, Legislative Concept 260, will be the Regional Solutions Bill. This bill, 260, fundamentally requires state agencies to take into consideration, these are state agencies that provide grants and loans, to take into consideration in their funding decisions those priorities that have come from regional solutions teams up through a rather elaborate process. Just to remind the committee, there are 11 of the regional solution districts. They all have a coordinator. They all have a convener. In the interest of full disclosure, I serve at the pleasure of the governor as the convener for my area. And these groups are assisted by advisory committees that represent individuals from business, government, academia, and philanthropy. In addition, they are supported by agency folks from specified agencies, and you will see in the bill draft those agencies articulated on page 3. They're DEQ, DLCD, I shouldn't use acronyms, sorry, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Land Conservation and Development, Department of Transportation, Housing and Community Services, Oregon Business Development, and other state agencies identified as appropriate to work on local problems. And so this bill will give direction to state agencies to simply consider in their funding priorities the work of the regional solutions. If a project comes up through regional solutions, it will have been vetted through a variety of different levels, starting with the regional solution team, the advisory committee, the work of the conveners. It's coordinated in a way not to usurp the authority or the responsibilities of the county commission or the city councils, and it defines projects that have high priority through this sort of elaborate method of vetting the projects. This bill also directs the members of the Regional Solutions Advisory Board to begin to try to figure out the implementation of the solutions. I'm sure that all of us have experienced wrestling with a difficult problem, going through the whole community process, coming up with a solution, and then not being able to find the money to implement. One of the beauties of regional solutions, in my observation, is that a problem is identified, agreed upon, the right people are pulled together to try to get to yes, and that includes raising the money. The most complicated regional solution project that I've personally been involved with was building 3 schools in Vernonia and raising $40 million. So I'm here to tell you this is a process that works. I watched those kids walk into that school on the first day. It is a process that works. I think it is the epitome of collaborative problem solving. This bill represents a lot of work by a lot of folks coming out of a bill from the last session that the chair was involved in, and I commend it for your thoughtful consideration to move forward in the 14th session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for our colleague?
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, well, Representative Thatcher.
Who was the rest of the cast of characters?
The cast of characters. Oh,
you were going to testify.
Be here. I think Matt Garrett was supposed to join us representing agency heads. I know Greg Wolf from the governor's office was supposed to be here. Mm-hmm. I have reason to believe that Garrett and Wolf are together somewhere.
They're coming later.
So it fell to me to make the case for the team.
Good. Okay. Well, good job.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you for your courtesy.
Back to your day, you bet. So I'm going to, I don't need to individually, yeah, we're just going to move over to the next LC. And just as a reminder, the way we're kind of structured today on our agenda, we've got 69, 260, 221, and 222. 69 is in a different, it's a different committee's committee bill, or somebody's bill. We only get three. The three that we're looking at are 260, 221, and 222. Mm-hmm. And that, and there'll at some point be a motion here to allow the introduction to those. 69 is one that I want us to talk about because it certainly relates to our mission, but it's not going to be part of our package later for introduction. But having said that, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. So if I can have Philip and Mike come up. And Ian, do you want to be in the first panel or come up with your growers?
I'll come up with this.
Okay, great.
So Chair Clem and members of the committee, for the record, Phil Kennedy Wong, Oregon Food Bank. Joining me is Mike Brand, who is the food strategic
sourcing
manager for Oregon Food Bank, that also works in collaboration with the 20 regional food banks in the network. And obviously we'll have farmers joining us, so Ian Tollison with the Farm Bureau. I want to give you a quick overview of what you'll be hearing in the next few minutes or so. And I want to start first by thanking you for this opportunity to talk about really the very, very important task of fighting hunger in the state of Oregon, and how we can do it with Oregon-grown foods that's fresh and nutritious to help, you know, really many people in the state succeed, whereby hunger has been a problem. So I'm going to, and then this panel will be shortly followed by a group of farmers that will be able to answer any questions that you might have, as we will describe to you what the crop donation practices have been in the past, what the food industry trends have been, and what we're proposing for the February session. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Mike.
Good morning, Chair Clem, the committee members. Thanks for seeing us. For the record, I'm Mike Moran, Strategic Sourcing Manager at Oregon Food Bank. First, I wanted to start just kind of a broad overview of, you know, the reason that we're talking to you and we're proposing the reinstatement of this tax credit that expired is that hunger in Oregon is still a significant issue, and we're still seeing significant increases in demand for emergency food services across the state, particularly in some of the more rural counties where need is really the highest. Part of the reason that we're focusing on agriculture and growers particularly is because the shape and nature of the food sources for donations that we see at the food bank have changed pretty dramatically over the past two decades, and particularly over the past 10 years. Just to give you a broad overview of the hunger situation, you can see on this map in the highlighting, that's the percentages highlighted in color of the percentage of families that are food insecure, and this is from USDA data on survey taken from the American Community Survey, and they publish these numbers every year. And they look on a county-by-county basis. As you can see, some of the hardest hit areas are the more rural counties, and that's actually where also some of the greatest resources are, particularly from agriculture. You know, 509,000 households every year lack consistent access to adequate food in our state. I think one of the things that strikes me the most is that over 280,000 children who qualify for free and reduced meals across the state. Summertime is a big time for us because those kids aren't in school and they still need to eat, and they're not getting those free and reduced meals in the summertime. And so they really look at the food bank and other sources, their local food pantries, to get that nutrition. So most of the food that we distribute comes in the form of donations, mostly from the food industry. You can see just in the past year, 57%, and that's our fiscal year ending in June of 2013. So far this year, in the first 6 months of our fiscal year, industry donations are actually up closer to 62-63%. That category far to the right, the purchase category, is relatively new to us. And the reason we're purchasing food, which we didn't really do very much 10 years ago, is that the demand for emergency food is increasing at a greater rate than the supply of donated food and other food. Additionally, USDA, which just 20 years ago was 80% of the food that food banks distributed, is now less than 20%, and in the last year it was only 15% of the total food. There's less food available through the Emergency Food Assistance Program in USDA, and that's a trend that, with the current climate in D.C., that we expect to continue. So really, where do we get the rest of the food for all of those families that need food? This is sort of gives you an idea. We look at the entire supply chain when we look at donations, and growers all the way to retail, and then all the processing, manufacturing, and distribution firms in between are really all the relationships we develop to get food into the emergency food system. And primarily what we're targeting is food that really was intended to be sold in some form in the marketplace, but for one reason or another, whether it's in manufacturing, it's past date, it's out of spec, dents and dings, all of those reasons that something then can't be sold is the stuff that we try to then get into the emergency food system. That center area, the manufacturing and processing, historically was the most food that we received came from that part of the industry. And in fact, up until probably about 5 or 6 years ago, it still was the vast majority of the food that we received, cans and boxes, really. And food banks, by and large, are a business built around cans and boxes. From the early USDA government cheese and non-fat milk, and most USDA supplies still come to us in some form of shelf-stable. But even the manufacturing stuff that we got is stuff that was very shelf-stable, very easy to move. However, that is also the most highly technical part of the entire supply chain. And so with lean manufacturing practices and technological advances, manufacturers are making fewer mistakes, and fewer mistakes are less donations. And that's just generally our reality. And so about 12 years ago, we looked more at the retail side of the spectrum because we realized we weren't doing much there with the grocery, our grocery partners. And we started a really pretty innovative program here in Oregon in 2001, and we saw a lot of rapid growth, picking up regularly at grocery stores the stuff that couldn't be sold. Right now, that what we call our Fresh Alliance program represents about 11 million pounds a year statewide that we're recovering from grocery stores. But now it's a mature program, and we're pretty much not expecting a lot of growth in that area because we're capturing pretty much everything that can be captured. So what do we do next? And that's where we're looking at agriculture. Growers really represent one of the biggest untapped or undertapped opportunities for us. We started very aggressively going after agricultural products about 4 or 5 years ago. We've seen dramatic growth over those past 5 years, going from roughly about 2.5 million pounds a year of fresh produce and other agricultural products to this year we'll be over 11 million pounds, or over 20% of our total volume. And as we finish up our strategic planning process for the next 5 years, we're really looking at that as our primary target. This just gives you an idea of some of the people that we partner with across the industry on the agricultural side. And we've got a lot of very strong relationships on agricultural processing with the Northwest Food Processors and their membership, but also with farms. Farmers Ending Hunger is one of our partners also that we really target very heavily, going after growers directly and reaching directly out to growers. And these are just sort of just give you an idea of who we work with. However, crop donations cost farmers. I mean, it's as much as the growers that we work with now really express the desire, and I have to say I have yet to have a conversation with anybody in agriculture, a grower, producer, rancher, that doesn't have the desire to help, that doesn't understand the need and understands there's a role for them and wants to do everything they can. But particularly when you're talking about crops that either have been planted and not harvested because the market has fallen out, they've been beyond contract with processors, but even stuff that's been intentionally produced as an addition to what they were already planning on growing. They were already going to put in 20 acres of green beans, so they put an extra acre in for us. There still are these costs to harvest, to clean, to sort, to pack those products. And the more and more that we ask them to do, the more those costs increase. And that's why we're looking at how do we offset those costs and avail ourselves of even more from the farmers that we already work with, but also as an incentive to bring on new farmers, help them find some recovery of some of those costs to get that product to us. So on the prior tax credit, which was established in 1977, really is a gleaning credit, and later matured to cover all crop donations. It was valued at about 10% of wholesale price. It covered fruits, vegetables, livestock, plant starts. So it really does. It covers all agricultural products. Plant starts actually became a very significant aspect of it towards the end of the credit before it expired because of the growth in community gardens and community gardening programs of getting plant start donations from nurserymen and other growers helped a lot of those community gardens get off the ground, and it gave a great incentive for them to donate those plant starts. But unfortunately, it did sunset in 2011. One aspect of it also that I want to point out that it does have it had a three-year carry-forward permit, knowing that in agriculture, in order for a tax credit to be meaningful, you have to have a profit, and in agriculture, not every year is profitable for growers. Mother Nature is always there to make things unpredictable. We wanted to keep a way that if they were making donations in years that were not profitable, they could use that credit in a year when things were a little bit more abundant. The problem is that only farmers that could afford to donate did. And also, the tax credit was really too low to influence the decision to donate. We heard that pretty consistently. And so after the sunset, we did see almost an immediate reduction in donations from some of our larger growers. One grower in particular was averaging about 400 to 500,000 pounds a year of root crop vegetables that he was donating. And after the sunset of the tax credit, he dropped down to about 45 to 50,000 pounds a year. And he's told us numerous times it is directly as a result of not having that tax credit. It is cheaper for him to disc those crops back in than to harvest them and donate them to us. So the LC69, it reinstates the tax credit with one major provision of increasing it from 10% to 15% to really address the economic realities of those costs to the farmer. And it would have a new sunset of 2020. Other than that, everything else about the tax credit remains the same as the prior tax credit. So it's a low cost and a high return. The way we look at it, about a dollar brings in 10.75 pounds of donated crops and provides about 9 meals to families experiencing hunger. It helps farmers to recover those costs of donation. But also, when you look at it, a lot of what we're paying for is those harvesting costs. So it keeps a lot of jobs and processing jobs moving as well. People that are out in the field doing the harvesting, doing the work, and working the packing lines, it keeps more people working longer. That's all I had.
All right. Deanne, are you talking now, or are you waiting with your guys, or should we do some
I can talk real briefly, okay, and then have some farmers come up.
Yeah, I want to do some questions before this panel leaves.
Okay. I'll be quick. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ian Tolleson with Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. And I think I would just like to echo the sentiments that Mike said. The food bank has done a great job of really zeroing on something that will help feed hungry Oregonians that need it, and really will hopefully help boost farmers in what they donate to food banks. In the Farm Bill at Congress, both provisions of the Farm Bill, House and Senate, has reduced SNAP, which is the food stamp program. So as those decline, I think the food bank really has a larger role to step in and increase donations. And I would just, again, you know, both the farmers that he works with and that I work with, we always hear that, you know, the 10%, not only is it low, but it's, you know, a lot of farmers don't want to have to go through and pay the extra CPA costs to do more taxes, so they don't go through with it. That doesn't mean that they don't donate, because I think it's quite interesting. All the farmers, they know they help supply the country and the state's food supplies, but that's something they like to do. But that comes at a cost, whether it be fuel, labor, water, transportation costs. So oftentimes you'll see crops stay in the field because of, like Mike said, because of market conditions or weather. So what this does really helps pull those crops out of the field into the food bank supply, and that will go to help feeding the people that need it here in Oregon. So that's about all I got. We have a group of farmers in here that use the program quite a bit, and they'll kind of tell you their perspective of how they deal with it, the challenges they have, and hopefully be able to answer some of your questions. Thank you.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for sharing the update with us. Question I have is, does this apply to food processors that are in the agricultural industry? In other words, say that Norpak Foods here, or just toured Don Poncho the other day, who contributes a lot to the Marion Polk food share here. Is it, once it's out of the field, does it still qualify?
Yeah, it's processors are included. It applies directly to agricultural crops, not finished goods, however. So, for example, a Don Poncho that's donating finished tortillas, that wouldn't be considered a crop to be for this tax credit. However, I would add, one of the reasons that I really feel strongly about adding this tax credit is that there is an existing enhanced federal deduction for food donations that allows a donation of manufactured goods, retail goods, so retailers, manufacturers, distributors can avail themselves of the federal enhanced deduction that allows them to deduct basically up to 150% of their costs of goods, not to exceed twice, or excuse me, one half the difference between cost of goods and fair market value, not to exceed twice cost of goods. Farmers, however, can't avail themselves of that, mostly because of the way that the federal enhancement, the enhanced deduction is structured, really only applies to C-Corps, and more importantly for growers, it only applies to businesses that are on an accrual accounting basis, and most farms are cash accounting just by the nature of their business. So really this is a way of allowing farmers to get some tax incentive that manufacturers and distributors already get on a federal level.
So for clarification, so for example, Norpak that produces a finished product, vegetables or soups or whatever, they would go through the federal, they're taking advantage of the federal program on those retail products as
correct.
A processor.
Thank and you. If I may, Representative Cameron, Chair Klim, we have a farmer that donates directly to Norpak, and she'll be able to talk about that relationship a little bit better.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Chair Klim. Just want a rough idea of how much this tax credit, for lack of a better term, cost every year on average.
So I believe that 10%, well, Phil, do you want to answer that?
Phil Kennedy Wong, Oregon Food Bank. We don't have an official revenue impact statement yet, obviously, because it hasn't entered through the process of getting filed. But we have worked with legislative revenue to get some sense of what the credit might cost, but they're, again, just estimates. So let me start first with the 10% credit, the old program that expired in 2011. I'm going to have to dig through my notes here. So hang on a second. I might have to do it off the top of my head, so... the early numbers, the numbers that legislative revenue has, I'm going to just have to go off the top of my head, go by memory, were actually very, very low just in terms of the annual impact. So going back, I think, to like the early 2000s, there are numbers like $60,000 annually to up to, I think the high point was $150,000 annually, and that was in 2011. There was sort of a period in which, as we got close to the 2011, the annual revenue impacts were roughly $80,000, $70,000 in that sort of range. Now, the unofficial estimate, if we kept the same tax credit at 10%, the legislative revenue gave us the unofficial estimate, again, of $250,000 for 2014. So it's going from 150 to 250 in 2 years. But, you know, that's, again, I think they're very cautious with their estimates. And the way that they typically do their estimates, they'll round it off to the nearest 100,000. So if there is like an official revenue impact statement, you might state that it'll be 300,000 but the estimates, you know, would be closer to probably 250. So fast forward to what a 15% tax credit, and having that as a background in the history and the donation practices, they're estimating, you know, somewhere between 380 to 400,000. So 400,000 would be the conservative end, them rounding off to the nearest 100,000. So again, these are all like estimates that are unofficial, and again, just based on the prior practices, I don't know if that'll bear true in reality. I don't want to.
Mr. Chair, I understand. I just kind of want a rough idea. Are we talking millions, billions? Apparently,
we got it.
Yeah, that's less than half a million. Rough round numbers.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. We understand this.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your presentation. I just pulled up, as a member of the Revenue Committee, I pulled up the tax expenditure report, and just in 2009-11, the cost of this credit was $200,000, rounded up probably to the nearest $100,000.
Yeah.
Just chump change here and there, right?
Mm-hmm.
$100,000 here, $100,000 there.
What's 40 grand?
There's some sort of phrase. But what's interesting is that the description of it, it talks about a point that you brought up regarding sort of how small the credit is and the fact that the old credit didn't incentivize behavior. That it gives an example of a farmer who donates 5 tons of potatoes, 10,000 pounds, might get a $65 tax credit, which is hardly enough to incentivize that farmer for all the cost involved. So my question is bumping it to 15% going to get us there to incentivize that?
Well, I think I'll take a stab at that. If you read further there, there's a recommendation by the Department of Agriculture for 50%.
I see that.
So, you know, I think it's hard to figure out where that point is, where you really increase donations.
Yeah.
Realizing the budget constraints the state's under, 50% might be hard to get to. When we first were talking about this, we thought, well, okay, then maybe 25%. We settled on 15% because, you know, as you know, the way the building works, you find a place where everyone's comfortable with. That is the current number.
Thank you.
And if I may, Mike Bryan, Oregon Food Bank, I would add that we know that growers who were, it wasn't, even at the 10%, it was an incentive for some growers who are no longer donating. And I think really right now we're talking 15 compared to zero.
Yeah.
Something will definitely have more of an impact than nothing.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a good point.
Questions? Okay, Ian, before I let you go, so farmers are your clients. They're, would you say they're the most important people in the world? They provide life and sustenance?
Chair Klim, I can think of no other people more important than the American farmer.
Thank you. Now, are more farmers Oregon State Beavers or Oregon Ducks? You're under oath. I remind you.
Well, Chair Klim, thank you for that question. As I have been working for the Farm Bureau for some time now, I've discovered most of them are Oregon State alumni, and
yeah,
they work
Beavers,
closely
we call, yeah,
with that fine institution.
Oh, yeah, good. Okay. Okay, you can go. Thank you. That's all I had. Beaver love here.
Beaver loving.
Okay, let's have our growers come up. Probably beaver in this mix. At least, well, I know there's one.
John Doe, Oregon State.
Yeah, I think so. If I remember right, I'm pretty sure. They do grow other stuff at U of O, and it's kind of an agricultural crop, and it might be legal at some point.
One of our
cash crops.
Is that not loud? Welcome. Who's starting? John, are you starting? Yeah, I've got you in ink on the first of my list, but anybody is fine.
Sure. Gentlemen first.
Okay.
Right. Representative Klim, committee members, good morning. My name is John Zielinski. Let's see. I'm with Easy Orchards. We have orchards just northeast of Salem here. Been a family farm there since the 1870s. We grow apples, pears, peaches, hazelnuts. We have a farm direct market. We sell lots of different produce from other farmers in our market also. We have a big harvest festival every year. We do school tours, have about 7,000 school children visit our farm every October. And we also are selling hard cider that we're making. So very diversified farm, and we are have donated to and have involvement with local food banks for many years. My mother has been on the board of directors for Marion Pope Food Share for, I don't know, it seems like forever, 10, 15 years, something like that. On our farm, we donate, on the wholesale side, between 30 and 80,000 pounds annually to Marion Pope Food Share. And for our farm market, we donate about 23,000 pounds this last year to SACA, Silverton Area Community Aid. They pick that up weekly from SACA. They're always so happy. They say, you know, we are so happy to get fresh produce. And they really, you know, emphasize that fresh element because so much of what they get is from a shelf-stable product, you know, that's, it's nice, but when everyone is talking about nutrition, they're often talking about the benefit of fresh vegetables and fruits. And so they're very happy to get that. For us to pick a bin of pears or apples and transport it out of the field, it's about $20. So to get that picked into the barn, into refrigeration, about $20 per, depending on whether it's apples or pears, 850 to 1,000 pounds. To refrigerate, pack the apples, box them, let's see, it's about $110 to $135 per 22 bushel bin. So a fair amount of expense can go into these products. And sometimes when we've donated, it's the simple fact of it's easier for us to donate, and not that it's also just the right thing to do, but it's easier to donate some apples or pears to the food bank if the market has shifted in there and we can't sell them than it is to go dump them on the ground, because then we have to work around that in the orchard and it's a mess. So it's easier to dump it, but it'd sure be nice if there was another incentive for that. Now that's our situation where we grow apples and pears. I'm also president of the Marion County Farm Bureau. We had our board meeting last night. There's several of our board members that donate to Marion Pope Food Share. An onion grower, another guy grows row crops, cauliflower, broccoli, cabbage, things like that. For them, it's a matter of if they've met their contract or the market has shifted, it's a matter of leaving it in the field. Mm-hmm. We have on occasion left apples on the tree, but for the most part, we always pick and hope that at some point the market will come up. But for them to decide, it's a matter of, is it worth the expense to go ahead and pick to make that donation? So I really liked the conversation about percentages, because I think 15% is selling the farmer short. I would love to see it at 25. I'm sorry to hope that doesn't undercut our staff, but I'd rather see it at 25 would be a much better percentage for farmers to incentivize them to donate to those who are hungry in the state of Oregon. Farmers work all year to grow produce, and they hate to see it not used. If a farmer is in the position of not being able to sell part or all of his crop due to market issues, contract overproduction, minor quality issues, or weather, it would be fantastic if there were an incentive to proceed with the last bit of expense for harvest and to donate the product to those in need. As they've already mentioned, there is the need. There are many hungry people in this state, and we just want to do what's right and be able to maybe get a little something back just to cover our cost and help feed those people. Thank you.
Okay. Piper, any next?
Representative, thanks. Now it's too tall. Representative Klim and committee appreciate the opportunity to be here and testify, or at least let you know what's going on with our farm.
Just for the record, can I have you say your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Piper, okay. Sweeney. My husband and I and his family farm in Dayton near McMinnville. And for us, we have gone through Farmers Ending Hunger, which works with the Oregon Food Bank. And we've had two or three years that we've donated. For us, we will plant an extra acre, and so the costs are there, and we know that we're, you know, we generally know we're not going to be selling that to our processor, which is NORPAC for that particular crop. But we also have times where we've got crop left in the field, and then it's a matter of the costs, you know, to us to get that out of the field, get it in for processing, to donate that way. So for us, you know, we'll use beets for example. If I take our beets to the processor and get paid for that, that's worth anywhere, you know, depending on the year, from $1,800 to $2,200. So if I take that crop and I don't, you know, collect that, well, those are real dollars to me. So it makes sense to me that would create a tax incentive, just as if I donated a certain amount of money. Then there is the year where you're leaving a bunch of crop that, you know, you're long on the crop or whatever. Well, then we're dealing with, you know, labor, the additional, you know, water, electricity, all the things that we need to harvest it. Do we make that effort? Because it's the right thing to do, you do want to do that. But when you're looking at your bottom line, you do have to consider is there some kind of incentive there? And not only for our farm where, you know, we have that direct tie. I'm on the board for Farmers Ending Hunger, so I hear about it. I hear about the need. I know that it's out there, and I want to be a part of the solution. But when it comes to the bottom line, I still have to sell it to our farm. Hey, this is something we want to do, and that 15% would make a difference there. If I go to my neighbors and I say, hey, I really want you to join this program, that 15% is going to make a difference. 25% would make more of a difference. But 15%, it is that tax incentive, and these are real dollars that are spent. So I would really, you know, I'm really hoping that we're able to put this into place, because I think it is important. I think it will help feed hungry people. Thank you.
And Sarah or Molly, I don't know who's who. So how about we just keep going down the line?
Thanks for having us. My name is Sarah Huca. I'm a small-scale organic farmer in Dexter, outside of Eugene. I'm a graduate of Oregon State University. And I represent the growing sector of small-scale and organic farmers, where I sell direct market. So there's a lot of product that isn't quite up to grade to sell to the public. You want to have your very best produce at the market, and I would say 60% of what I grow is not what I want to have shining at the market stall. So there's always a value of leftover product or slightly damaged product, you know, compost or chicken food or pig food. If I can have an incentive to donate that and get tax credit for it, I would do that instead of some of the other outlets for it. I'm lucky to have Food for Lane County nearby and a local food pantry even closer, that access to being able to donate is very available. And I would take advantage of that opportunity with an incentive. And that's all I have.
Representative Clem, committee. My name is Molly McCarger, and I am with Pure Mind Farms. I'm a fourth generation farmer. My brother and I have taken over the operation, and we're just outside of Jervis. I don't know why we don't have a Kaiser address, but we're right between the middle of them. And so when you drive to the Wheatland Ferry, you can see us. Just to give you an idea, we have been participating with Farmers Ending Hunger since almost its inception, and through NORPAC. We grow for 600 acres of vegetables for NORPAC, and out of that we every year donate an acre of green beans and an acre of corn. And with that, what NORPAC does is they know what our cannery average is for that season, and so that's what they take and break out and say, all right, you have just now donated. For example, in 2012, we donated 17,634 pounds of green beans, and that's net. That's good, good beans, not the no value. And then we also donated 19,852 pounds of corn. And so the dollar value is what we would be paid for Norpak's prices. I would much rather have a fresh market price, but we'll take it. Norpak also incurs costs to this, because what they do is they get it to the frozen product in bulk, and then they then from there distribute it to through Farmers End Hunger to the Oregon Food Bank, and then that's where the volunteers take over. But Norpak doesn't incur that cost of processing and getting it frozen. They also donate finished goods as well throughout the year to Marion Polk Food Share, and so that's where they probably take advantage of the federal tax credit. And so I think that, from if I understand it correctly, that the processing of the food for Farmers End Hunger would take advantage of this credit through the state for those pounds. And I believe there's almost 20 farms from Norpak that donate through Farmers End Hunger, and Norpak has had to put a cap on that because it is a cost to the company, which then is a cost to us as owners of the company. So we're kind of donating twice to some degree, really. We're donating twice. And so they would like to be able to open up and say we'd like 30 growers of the 240 to be able to donate. But, you know, not all 240 farmers are really, you know, comfortable with donating. So And since it's a grower-owned co-op, it can be a challenge. But that's one portion. And our farm also donates directly to Marion Polk Food Share. And in 2012, we donated 26,368 pounds of food that was harvested actually by Salem Harvest, a group of volunteers that comes out and harvests anything that's excess or left over. Or oftentimes we'll have them come out and just harvest side by side when we're picking something. We also donate crops for Farmers End Hunger, but then we started a pumpkin patch a couple years ago because I couldn't afford to go to John's. I'm a farmer, and I can grow some pumpkins, right? And so we decided to, and then we're like,
I'm going to have to change. I mean, we usually, wow, boy.
Is that a deal you can make me?
They have cider donuts, though.
I know. And it sounds like hard cider now. So maybe I should just quit and start visiting easy again. But we started doing that, and it was kind of like just for fun for my kids. And then my dad said, well, let's donate. But how we can get people out there? Well, let's just donate everything that we generate from it. So we set aside 5 acres, and everything that people pay, we give away, essentially. And so in 2012, I think we raised $6,800 that the consumer gets to choose whether they want to go to the Marion Polk Food Share or the Farmers End Hunger. And then that's where we allocate it at the end of the year. And so we had, and we also collect food from that. And part of the reason our farm has decided to donate in all these various ways is because it's the right thing to do. When you have kids and you see their friends hungry, it's kind of hard. So our school district, I'm the Jervis School District, we are 84% free and reduced. I'm on the school board. I have 4 kids. I see it every day. I have kids who come out to the pumpkin patch with their one can to go through the corn maze, and oftentimes I have found that the can has already come through the Marion Polk Food Share. So, kind of a big deal. So we have taken it upon ourselves, and when you have 1,100 students in your district and 924 of them are free and reduced, it matters. We'll continue to keep doing it. My accountant would rather have it much easier, more streamlined, and not as, because we already have enough issues with farm taxes as it is, that it'd be easier for him. But 25% would be fantastic. I'll take 15. If we can negotiate, that'd be good. So anyway, there's no such thing as surplus when it comes to food. If there was such a thing, we wouldn't have a hungry state or a hungry nation. So something to think about. When we say we have extra, really we don't. We just don't. have a place to take it. So we take it to those that need it. So.
Great. Thank you all for coming, too. Vice Chair Cameron?
Yeah. Thank you for what you do. And just as a person who's operated restaurants here in the Valley and the state, Cafe Today, we've worked with farmers in ending hunger, and so the product that you actually donate ends up coming once a year. We usually sell soups for a day, and all the proceeds, all our labor goes to farmers ending hunger too. So there's a good partnership at the retail level with some of the businesses, and it's been great, a great partnership. We're honored to do it, and thank you for what you do to help us turn that into some cash for farmers ending hunger. So thanks.
Vice Chair McKeown.
Oh, and Ms. McCarver, I, as a former school board member with a demographic that equals yours, I clearly understand where you're coming from and the heartfelt nature in which you bring this message, because we have a problem, and you are all helping us in your way every day solve it, and I'm grateful for the work that you do and that you do understand that this is something that is really critical, especially to our children.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for coming down and sharing kind of how it works and what's important about it. I don't know. Well, he's shooting high. So while I've got everybody here, if you don't mind, why don't we do the committee introductions, and then you can leave if you need to. This is a short way of saying this.
You want me to just move them?
Yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, I'll move LC 260, LC 221, LC 222 be adopted as committee bills.
Vice Chair Cameron moves that following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 221, 222, and 260. And I'll remind you, voting to introduce them in no way lends support to the bills or implies support to the bills. It's just a part of the process to get them in. Otherwise, I wouldn't ask you to do this before you've even heard more about them. But you're obligated. I don't even know if these will come to our committee, for example. But if they do and you want to vote for them or don't want to, that's your business later. And that's the way committee bills generally are thought of. Not always, but that's the way I think of them. And typically, that's the way most people think of them. So any discussion or any questions you do want to ask about these? We'll hear more about the bills in a moment. Okay, any objection to introduction? Okay, seeing none, the committee bills are introduced. Okay, now back to our bills. So let's go to LC 260. Matt and Nathan both want to join us. So this, we heard a little bit from Senator Johnson, actually quite a bit, quite thorough, but whatever else you've got to tell us, we're happy to hear about. I think the other one was quite compelling, so we went a little late, so if you go shorter, we're not going to complain.
Certainly appreciate that, Chairman Clem and members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I have the privilege of chairing a steering committee specific to House Bill 2620, which I think is the jump-off point, and what is merged into the LC we're to speak to today. With me is Nathan Ricks. Nathan works out of Mike Jordan's shop over at the Chief Operating Officer's office, and Nathan is the project manager for the effort specific to House Bill 2620, which, again, you'll recall, has us coming back to you and your colleagues in 14 with a plan on how to align and integrate grant loan programs in those agencies that make up the economic and community development discipline or outcome here. I can tell you that a lot of pick and shovel work. The steering committee is comprised of roughly a dozen or so agency heads, both economic community development as well as some natural resource folks, because again, embedded in 2620 was that effort to bring the natural resource individuals into the regional solutions conversation, and regional solutions becomes the apparatus here, as does the regional solutions priorities. And what we're seeing here in the LC is the concept of codifying or placing in statute the disciplines associated with regional solutions, and from that their priorities. And with those priorities, what we're taking is a first step, because I will tell you, this is not a one-and-done situation. This will be an evolutionary process as we align and integrate. But the first step is to take existing programs, align those up with regional solution priorities via criterion, for all intents and purposes. So no huge structural changes to the extent working within, as a first step, the existing structure we have, but actually pivoting in a direction that will continue to evolve and move forward. So I think there's some structural change in terms of the conditions that we place within the various grant and loan programs that speak to infrastructure and capacity investment in our communities across the state. I would also submit to you the second issue, or the flip side of the coin, is a change in disposition. I think one of the things we know, if we are to deliver outcomes and deliver the products, is to move beyond just basic compliance or checking the box. How can we engage a situation to ensure that those local needs are being dealt with? And we actually come to the table as state government with an attitude to deliver on those outcomes. So there's an attitudinal shift that comes with it, and I think that's important. That's not articulated in the bill, but certainly as the conversation played itself out across the state, and we have traveled across the state talking to individuals about how they react to the concepts of being a little more nimble, being a little more focused in terms of regional solutions and their priorities. And we have the conversations about the composition of the regional solutions team, the regional solutions conveners, the how projects are vetted. All those are legitimate, and I think those are the conversations that need to transpire starting today as we move through September, because I think that will help craft and tailor what becomes a piece of legislation that I think will bring benefit and actually put more product on the ground to meet those priorities that have been identified at the bottom level through a broad consensus group of folks identifying this is where the state needs to help us across the communities here in the state of Oregon. I think Nathan can speak to some of the mechanics engaged here, but Mr. Chairman, those are just the opening remarks from the charge we were given with House Bill 2620. We are moving in the right direction. We are aligning. We are syncing things up. And I think when we come back in February, you will see that we have taken the first step in the transformation that we have heard from the chairman and some of his colleagues as to what truly is the intent behind that alignment effort. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I turn it over to Nathan. He can talk about the mechanics, so to speak.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Ricks, and I'm a Strategic Initiatives Project Manager in the Office of the Chief Operating Officer in the Department of Administrative Services. And what I'd like to do is preview what we're going to contain in our implementation plan, and also connect the dots between the mandate that the 2013 legislature gave us in 2620 with LC 260, and tell you a little bit about the public engagement that we did in the process. The first key piece I'd like to share with you is some of the values and assumptions that we made in the steering team. Really, one of the foundational blocks as we started the public engagement was that we have some pockets of excellence and some success of agency coordination and alignment that we really want to be able to capitalize on and build on. So we were looking actively for those opportunities and for evidence of that in our public engagement. Second, we gave high value to the idea that we need to be able to capture immediate opportunities. When an opportunity presents itself for community or economic development, we want to be equipped to be able to capture that. And second of all, we discussed at great length the commitment to create a better end user experience for Oregonians. So as we launched our public engagement, first what we did was we engaged a group of statewide stakeholders. We sent out through a number of different methods, one of which was the Oregon Kitchen Table Project through Portland State University and Metro's opt-in survey platform, an open-ended survey which asked Oregonians what their experience had been with state services in the past. And you know, in our research, we had seen lots of different other surveys that had been done. The Oregon Cities did one in 2009. Our office and the Chief Operating Office in 2012 came out with a regulatory streamlining report, but we really didn't have that qualitative data of Oregonians' experience with state services. So we asked them these open-ended questions, got over 2,000 participants, and then we analyzed those thematically. After we analyzed those, we came up with themes and pushed those out to a group of experts, held a summit of program team managers and also program team users and interested citizens that had partnered with the state in the past. And we asked them really some four key questions. First was, what is your current experience with state programs? Second, where do you see fragmentation? Where have you experienced overlap? And third, where have you seen duplication? And then if you were to reimagine the system, what would you change? What would you do differently? And how could existing resources be reallocated or changed in a way that would make community and economic development better for you? With that survey information and with the information we gathered from that group of experts, we then created some scenarios, which we will contain in the report. Most of those scenarios have to do with industrial land development, creating flexible funding to be able to capture immediate opportunities, and also some ideas around creating a common application for different state services. And really the sort of the bottom line of LC260 as we envision it is this is one step forward from the 2620 plan of looking at existing statewide grant and loan programs and really identifying how regional solutions priorities can be integrated into those existing grants and loans in order to meet those regional priorities.
Okay, any questions for these gentlemen? I should call him Chairman Holby because this bill came through his committee, so he's probably wondering why, what's back. I'm trying to wrestle it back, but...
Representative Holby.
Yeah, and happy to give it to the rural communities. But
that's what I'm talking about.
So I'm just curious, speaking of rural communities, so are these regional solutions centers been established throughout the state, and I'm kind of curious because those regions are, I guess, described by the Department of Commerce, U.S. Department of Commerce. And so are they inclusive of the whole state, and have we got centers and people established in each one of those so that the whole state's got coverage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ho, yes, correct. There are six centers for all intents and purposes, one being a satellite in the Tillamook area. But they're stood up and they cover the whole of the state. And there is an alignment with the local economic development districts here, so there's an overlay. Obviously, there are many boundaries that you can carve a map up, whether it's a Department of Transportation boundary, economic community development, but we're pretty close. So we have covered the state. And what we have seen is over time, the growth, you'll recall back in the late 90s, so to speak, this actually started with Governor Kitzhaber and the Community Solutions team. There's been evolution, different focuses for all intents and purposes, but what we now arrive at is a much more robust apparatus in terms of these regional solutions teams, advisory groups that are made up of not only state government, but local government, nonprofits, academia. What we're trying to do is ensure that we have all voices within a region and forming those priorities to ensure that if indeed we are going to now direct or at least place criteria and maybe weight criteria to those priorities, that we have those priorities embraced by all, that all voices have had an opportunity to put their fingerprint on it and ensure that. And by the way, we'll continue to refresh those because of this dynamic and the group of folks that we bring around the table. It's very robust. I think we have seen successes. You can point to the success of a more disciplined and a collective wisdom coming to the table and forming the host of opportunity across the communities of the state.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. So I'm just curious if there is available a map that shows us these regions that our staff could share. I know there is one somewhere.
There it is.
Okay, it's in our documents already.
Actually, I just Googled Regional Solutions Oregon, and it comes up through the State of Oregon website.
I think, Mr. Chairman,
are there contacts already in place?
Well, I think there's an opportunity, and appreciating the committee's time, happy to make a phone call, set up a meeting, sit down with you, and walk through it. I think you'll find it fairly robust and impressive.
It sounds great.
Thank you. So
Vice Chairman McKeown.
It covers urban areas, too, though, I imagine.
That's correct. That's correct.
Mr. Chair, you know, it might be helpful for this committee. I've been involved in our local regional solutions projects, and just to clarify for us, regional solutions has been in place now for two, how long?
We'll change names and numbers.
Yeah.
This
94.
Originally, it goes back to the mid late 90s as Community Solutions. It's evolved. It stayed through Governor Kitzhaber's first terms, morphed a little bit to an economic recovery conversation under Governor Kulongoski, and then has come back in its current form. So it's a known.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I've had the privilege of working with our local regional solutions because they're involved in economic development in my community, and I've had an opportunity to actually see the process work from start to finish in a couple of different cycles, and it might be helpful for this committee to have somebody from that shop come in and walk through it or show us a map. I think there are 11 regions.
Across,
is that correct?
There are six core teams, but they spread across the regions. That's exactly what
that are established with
multiple.
A convener and a.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Correct. Just wanted to clarify that, and it's a wonderful process to watch work. It's ground roots and community based, and it comes out of what the community designate their needs are, and I'm pleased to see us moving forward with a little bit different iteration and some more integration. So, thank you.
If we do manage to get this bill, we will have more detail. I don't know if we're going to get it. I'm going to try hard.
Okay.
But I'm down there. I don't know how if I'm going to get it or not. We'll see. Representative Thatcher.
Excuse me. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I think of community development, while I think of economic development, to include economic engines such as the private sector. And I see a lot of government, like you said, academia, nonprofits. Well, usually economic development includes some profit. Sorry, that might be a dirty word in here, but anyhow. So I'm wondering, how do you receive input from the stakeholders from the private sector?
Yeah, I think the private sector. I mean, that's one of the seats at the table, so to speak. Now it changes. I think the groups are allowed to tailor the composition to some extent. But no, you have the private sector informing that conversation.
For example, the ones I've been involved with, you might have a regional economic development entity through their membership bring businesses who are literally involved in a project, like SEDCOR might bring somebody, or So Ready might bring somebody, or their exec director might be the one at the table. Like the very first one was this gravel thing up in Skaphoose, and it involved a company and a developer who owned it, and finally made a deal to move it up a ways to free up room for now what probably will be a community college campus. And the developer, and the owner of the, they had to come to, the money's worth it for us to move because we already own this site. How much are we going to have to pay? But eventually it got worked out. They got moved. The land got converted over to essentially, farming for now. But last session, 20 years later, we just authorized a community college to go there. So, that's if it's really specific project, I think there's a business involved. Otherwise, it's often the regional economic development groups, if they have them, I think, representing
business. Like
SEDCOR
and things like that.
Yeah, right. Okay. Or a chamber, maybe.
So you mentioned this, Chair Clem, this example you just gave. I'm wondering, would this be the appropriate place to discuss land use, such as industrial lands that are set aside but aren't attractive to the industry that would likely most like that, but they would like this other set of land, maybe swapping. So would be the appropriate venue to bring up something like
Chairman
that? Chairman
Clem,
so.
Representative Thatcher, spot on. I think if you look at the priorities, and again, we'll, in our information we'll provide the committee, you will see that land use issues are significant priorities across, and industrial sites, the industrial sites of making sure that there's a potential investment from state government. But that's usually money that is leveraged significantly many times over. So it's not the largest amount. It may make up a quarter at best. But at the same time, there's the conversation that plays itself out in terms of permitting. How do we bring a better discipline to that? Not lowering in any way the environmental stewardship responsibilities, but ensuring that when you engage a conversation for an industrial site, that there's a bird in the hand, so to speak, that you can walk through a process with some surety in terms of the financial resource, in terms of the permitting conversation. So that's all part of the discussion here. We don't lead with our chin on anything. Again, the scrutinies are rigorous here. We will not harmonize down on the permitting process here, but we can bring a predictability and a surety in terms of timelines. And I think that helps promote infrastructure investment, industrial site, land use type issues, workforce issues. We can bring a focus that I guess one could say, shouldn't you already be doing that? Yeah, but here's an opportunity to actually codify it and move it forward. I would say that the legislative concept we have in front of us, I think there's more work to be done. I think there's clarity in terms of what we're trying to do in terms of codification and how it fits with monies that have been directed to the regional solutions. I think that'll take place somewhere else rather than in this concept. But more importantly, how the state agencies and those existing programs we have with existing objectives, how, again, do we insert the appropriate criteria so we won't compromise or change policy, but we complement the opportunities that will play themselves out with these regional priorities.
And I think particularly if there's some more novel concept like we're going to use transferable development rights or something we don't typically do as a matter of course, you want to have a group looking at it up front that includes the regulators so later you don't show up with your idea and they have no idea what you're talking about, no ownership, and they're like, well, we don't really do that. If everyone's already come up with it, like, yeah, okay, now what do we got? What authorization? What can we do? And then it's, you know, everyone's trying to get to yes instead of more like, well, give me your application and I'll review it, tell you what I think. That's not all, that's scary because you got to make do all the work to make the application. You don't even know how it's going to be received.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Vice Chair McHugh.
And Director Garrett, I'm happy to hear you talk about, or your reference to time frames. One of the things I hear in my community and in developing of projects is, in the permitting process, time uncertainty is the biggest killer of financing for a project, is not knowing when the permit is going to be awarded. So I think it's something that I would love to see continue to be on the forefront, is that time certain. If you say it's going to take 180 days, it ought to take 180 days. And I'm glad to hear you reference that.
So we have to get NAMPS on
Chair Clem, Representative McEwen.
We have to get the feds on our committee, too.
Well, there's no question, but I think Chairman Clem is hit. The ability to get everybody at the front end,
yeah,
all parties, including the regulators, to make sure there's a clear understanding of the objectives and the discipline that will be instilled. I think if you can do that, that's going to make sure that we don't have several bites of the apple. That the investment up front will yield a dividend in the end. And that's part of this process. Get everybody around the table. Ensure those voices are there. And then engage the issue and deliver a product.
Thank you.
Okay. Actually, we've got to get moving, I think. I've went on too long here. But it was both vice chairs. I went and looked at both vice chairs and the chair's original bill. We like it. We hope it comes back to this committee sometimes, not other committees. And with that, we're going to move on to the next LC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
He voted for it and let it out of his committee. I should probably stop passing
instead of us searching for it.
Okay,
let's go to Karen, and are you going to bring Paul or either or both? And this is LC. I skipped right past.
Uh-oh.
Hold on, sorry. One second.
You can do that. It's fine.
Yeah? Time constraints? Okay, come on. I got you halfway up here, so okay. Sorry about that. LC, let's do LC 222.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Karen Godden. I'm Managing Director of Business Innovation and Trade Division within Business Oregon. I will just take a few minutes. I know you're running late. What I would like to do is talk in support of LC 222 about entrepreneurial development and the appropriations of additional or monies to our Industry Competitiveness Fund to fund entrepreneurial industry development funds. The LC also includes an increase to the cap on the entrepreneurial loan program that Business Oregon administers. The cap would be increased from $70,000 to $100,000 and extend the loan amortization period, which is currently set at 5 years, not to exceed 10 years. speaking to the appropriations or monies for the industry competitiveness funds to fund entrepreneurial and industry development activities. We particularly are interested in these funds to help us deploy around our cluster-based rural economic development strategy. Our business, regional business development officers, particularly Chris Claflin, has brought forward that in his communities, the counties that he serves, Coos Curry and Douglas County, that he sees a great need to have more resources to support business starts, business opportunities, entrepreneurial, micro-enterprise businesses. We have a partnership relationship with the Oregon Entrepreneur Network that does provide and host programs that brings community business universities, community colleges, the economic development regions, and other technical providers together to help serve entrepreneurs who are looking to grow, whether it's startup or existing businesses, to assist in that. The pilot project that we are starting this month, we have funded at about 50% of what we would like to fund it at. These additional funds would help us. The pilot project in Coos Curry and Douglas is about having a dedicated resource who could bring together, identify entrepreneurs, assess what they need, what are some of the market resources that exist, and begin to help give them access to maybe angel funds, our certainly our entrepreneurial EDLF loan program, mentoring, helping to really build and foster many of our program services, the traditional business retention, expansion, and recruitment services, and our traditional lending programs really aren't the right fit for the types of businesses, particularly the new starts and ventures. So this would allow us to provide some resources and build out and have additional programs, rural-based focused program for entrepreneurial strategies and development. Particularly, we have a request from the Klamath region to also start a pilot project. Eastern Oregon is another area where we're looking at doing this.
Sorry, just one second. One of my colleagues, right, is Representative Gilliam. The bill you were a chief co-sponsor of from 2013, I'm sure you remember it, House Bill 2620, we just talked about it and the follow-up. Did you want to come talk some more about that?
Is this the bill regarding farmers getting credit
for food? No. I'm sure you chief co-sponsored that bill, too.
No, it's only if they donated half of it.
It was a statue. It was about a statue and a Senator Hatfield and...
Can't stand it.
We do. Sorry, I just can't resist. This is a charming actor. I'm Representative.
Thank you, Representative Clem. I think Paul would like to add.
Sir?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Business Development Department. I'd just like to add one point. In November, during the legislative days, you had heard from the National Organization of Legislatures regarding entrepreneurial strategies, things being done in other states. And one of those items was specific to fostering and promoting rural economic development. And the concept that Karen is describing and the program, the EDLF program, really gets to that point as one of those key objectives to help further rural communities and rural development.
And I think it seems like you had a flat tire that day, so we're
I apologize.
No, this worked out.
Not a good day for me, and particularly I missed the opportunity to actually hear the presentation, but had talked to Brian the day before.
Yeah. So it was interesting, and obviously, I mean, we're trying to follow up with some action out of it. So thank you for your help, both days and getting ready.
Absolutely. Maybe I can talk about the entrepreneurial loan program and the request to increase the funding.
You don't have to spend a ton of time because it'll be a ways and means deal.
Okay.
We'll say yes and then they'll give us the real truth at some point.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Then maybe we want to move to questions.
Any questions for our panel? Yeah, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand. Are you taking some I guess, an existing program and basically expanding it or duplicating it in a way that's more specific to rural. Is that kind of the bottom line?
The Industry Competitiveness Fund is a program that allows us to work with partners and organizations to deliver services to businesses. It isn't funds that go directly to companies. We use some resources within the Industry Competitiveness Fund. We fund the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Program, our trade promotion programs. We have allocated roughly $125,000 out of this fund to do entrepreneurial services. Most of those services are being provided along I-5 and I-84 in terms of communities. We're looking to expand this so we can get out into more rural-based communities.
And just for your information, in case you read about other bills, and there is another concept coming out of the Senate, I believe, doesn't have the Section 9, or it's not called Section 9, Sub 9 on page 2 that has the targeted language around rural communities, but has the lifting of the raising of the cap on the potential loan amount. And I don't know if it has the money in there or not, but yeah. So this was something that I had asked them to work with us to develop after our last hearing, just more specific to rural communities with this additional language about sort of targeting rural communities.
Thank you. And just to clarify, whenever I hear the word loan in a government context, I always have to ask the question, is this one of those forgivable loans?
How does the program work now?
No, it isn't a forgivable
loan.
It operates on a revolving loan basis.
It. So it's actually repaid. Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. If we end up getting this bill, we'll see you again in February. Thank you. Hoping with the word rural communities in there, there's a shot. I don't know. I'm just going to start putting that in every bill now and see what happens. Don't tell the speaker, please. Okay, let's go back now to the nice people I skipped and ask Aaron and Dave. And Representative Davis, do you want to go down?
What the heck?
So this is, we've had everybody coming up. We've had a few discussions about this in the committee, maybe some before Vice Chair McEwen joined us, about kind of LIDs and some specific situations, and then generally then I asked, I think Vice Chair, Representative Davis wasn't here one day, so I assigned him to chair a worker, and he's been working really diligently all through the holidays, very hard, and had a lot of input, a lot of email traffic that I've been trying to understand, and we're going to hear a little bit about where we're at, hoping to be ready and not long for this bill to come back to us in February. So, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair Clem.
Chairman of the subcommittee work group, Davis. Chairman Davis.
thank you, Chair and Committee. I'd like to preface this with some children, when they're growing up, they have pictures of sports stars on their walls or fast cars. When I was 8, dreaming of being a state representative, I had whole statutes of local improvement districts on my wall. And I dreamt of a day that I would be in a conference room with representatives from our great cities debating changes to the local improvement district statute. So I want to thank you personally, Chair Clem, for that opportunity.
I noticed you were here on time today and haven't left the room. So I have more work groups waiting for that moment.
But I actually would like to say it's been a very informative experience. I'd like to thank particularly Aaron Doyle for the wonderful summary of local improvement districts, which I've asked to be posted to OLIS. I think in 95-99% of situations, local improvement districts are a wonderful tool that are used voluntarily by cities and property owners to finance infrastructure improvements that otherwise wouldn't get built. And so they're a tool that we want to remain flexible. We want to remain usable for every city, county, and local government in the state. It's also interesting to look state by state. I did just a brief survey of California, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon about our enabling statutes, and do we have any limitations on them? Because the charge of the work group was to potentially place some sideboards on our local improvement district statute to prevent situations like the Rollins have experienced in the city of Kaiser. And it really varies. California and Idaho both do have sideboards built into their statute. I can describe those, but it would be very technical. Idaho, for example, only allows a maximum of 20% of the assessed value to be assessed as part of an LID on any particular property. California has some limitations on if there is a majority property owner within the district, how much their vote counts. Washington is the most liberal in terms of, it basically says cities and counties are empowered to have LIDs. Go. And Oregon is somewhere in the middle. Essentially, we do have a very liberal LID statute, which says cities and counties can develop ordinances to do this, and it provides a notice period that property owners will receive that a proposed district is going to be placed on their property. But that is currently the only limitation that I can really see in statute is that notice period that's provided. So the nut that we tried to crack here is how do we maintain maximum flexibility for cities and local governments while addressing sort of the 80-20 situation. And the 80-20 situation is what happened in the Rollins and is what happened in a few other instances in the state of Oregon, where you have one property owner, let's take 20 acres, where one property owner owns 15 of those 20 acres or 18 of those 20 acres that would be within a particular district. By definition, under most city and county ordinances authorizing LIDs, because that one property owner controls the majority of property in a district, their vote, what they decide to do, can be imposed on those neighboring 5 or 4 or 3 acres. And that's essentially what occurred in this instance. I will also say that there are two methods that cities and counties take for imposing LIDs. One is a sort of council-driven process where by ordinance, whether it be for health, safety, or maintenance, or because of a city priority, cities can initiate the process for imposing an LID and assessing properties. And in every instance that I've heard of, cities have engaged property owners and tried to get them to the table and reach agreement. There's also the flip side where property owners say, hey, I don't have a sidewalk built, I don't have a road built, let's all of us on the street go to the city and petition the city to impose an LID, and in most of those cases you have 70, 80, 90% of property owners who want to have that assessment because it's going to, over the long run, improve their property values and their living situation. So how do we crack that nut of maintaining that maximum flexibility while addressing the 80-20 situation where one property owner could potentially override their neighbors? What we've done here is what we have said, although this is a 16-page statute, you know how LC gets, they start cleaning up language, they start fixing things. It's really a 5-page bill. It's not a 16-page bill. It starts on page 2 and ends on page 6. That's where the substance of this bill is. And what it does is it provides particular notices to property owners and an opportunity to comment on, A, what properties are going to be included in the assessed district, a map of that district so they can actually see who their neighbors are, and the estimated assessment, and a brief description of the type of improvements to be built. There's a notice piece to the statute. The other piece that's been added is a substantive piece where if you receive a notice that a city or your neighbors want to try to impose a district and 50% or more, or a majority, 50% plus one vote of property owners in that district object in writing to the city may not impose that district unless there's a written determination that there's a health or safety emergency that requires the district to be imposed. Because there are some situations, for example, in Portland where districts have been imposed involuntarily, frankly, because the property is just completely deteriorating and owners are not taking care of it. Now, how do we address the situation where you have one property owner who has that 51% vote? What it says here is if you have a property owner that owns 50% or more of the property, you take out their vote for purposes of all the other properties. So you've got the 80-20 owner. Mm-hmm. The 80% owner doesn't get to say what the assessment's going to be for the other 20%. When it comes to that objection vote only, and not with respect to that 80% property owner and their property, they can still do what they want with their 80%, but they cannot impose their will upon that 20%. And that 20% gets an opportunity to say whether or not they want to move forward with the assessment with respect to their property alone. And that goes back. It's basically 50% of the 20% at that point. That's how the vote is counted. So it's not
individual. I mean, you could be in the 49% of the 20%.
That's correct. And you'd still be imposed on you. That's right. So it still maintains the 50% threshold, but within that 20% and doesn't include the vote of the 80.
Yeah.
Now, if the 80% really wants to go forward with this project because they need it, they want it, and they want to, they can still choose and go to the city and say, okay, we'll pay for this project to go forward, and it'll benefit some properties even though they don't want to pay it. So, in this instance,
and in that scenario, if the whole project fails, though, and that person doesn't pay, those other people aren't
that's correct.
Stuck with the
it's
bill.
Not assessed on their properties.
Yeah.
That's right. That's correct.
That's
so the nut that I think we've been able to reach here, that we want to crack, is property owners can still come before cities, and in, like I said, 90% of cases where it's voluntary, everybody's getting along and they want to do an LID assessment, great, they can still do it. Provides a notice opportunity and provides a substantive objection opportunity. So that's what we've tried to achieve in this brief 16-page, easy-to-read bill. And I'll just turn it over to my colleagues for...
So I'm going to pause for just a second because another one of our colleagues came in on time like he was told to, and let him just briefly tell us about his bill, if you don't mind. So maybe... do you want to swap out and then...
Yeah,
you can stay. And then, Representative Benz, do you want to come talk to us about your LC? And just say, it's fine. He doesn't buy it. No one buys, I don't think. Maybe Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cliff Benz, District 60, here talking about LC 17, which everyone here should be familiar with because we passed it through the House 53-7 just a few short months ago. And this is the bill that would allow Malheur County the opportunity to compete with Idaho, which it shares border with for about 200 miles, and you've already heard me talk about it at length.
Any changes?
None.
Any?
It's exactly the same bill. Just bringing it back again in the hopes that working with various groups that were unhappy with the speed at which the bill moved last time, and they want to talk about process and make sure that this time they're heard on their concerns about the approach to economic development in Eastern Oregon. So I don't need to take any more of your time other than to hope that we can do this, because the original reason for having this opportunity was the poverty problem we have in Malheur County, which vacillates between the poorest and not quite the poorest county in Oregon. Much of that is driven by the fact that we compete with Idaho, which is hugely challenging given their approach to land use. They don't have an approach to land use other than show up and build it.
Yeah, use it however you want.
Right,
use it.
Use it approach.
Yeah. Use it. Kind of awesome.
Now, farming is using it. The EFU, we do farm there, some of us. Okay, any questions for Representative Benz?
Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming down and, being available. Okay, back to LC 221. So two work group members, there's more, but why don't you tell us about the draft from your, where you're sitting?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. I'll break the trend of today's committee meeting. Proud graduate of the University of Oregon. The team that went to the war.
Okay. Boy.
Okay.
All right.
This will show that.
Let's just move right past that. Move on.
Representative Davis did a good job of summarizing the bill. That there are some really some key points, and Mr. Chair, you instructed us and tasked us with putting sideboards on, and as we've testified every time that we've had that we've been in front of this committee on this concept, nobody wants to make the LID process unworkable. We all recognize the importance of LIDs as a financing mechanism for infrastructure needs, and we want to continue doing that. But at the same time, there needs to be some modest sideboards to ensure that people are treated, the property owners that are going to be put into the district are treated fairly. And I think LC 221 does that. Four main things that the bill does, most of which have been touched upon by Representative Davis, and the key one to me is it provides notice and information to allow property owners to make an informed choice. One of the hallmarks of the LID process is that property owners are both notified and given an opportunity to vote whether or not to agree to become part of the district, and if there is enough opposition, then the district doesn't form. The problem with the current statutes is there's no requirement that the property owner at the time that the choice is made by the city council whether or not to form the district, that the property owners have adequate information to make an informed choice. And really the information that most property, I would suspect that most property owners are going to care about is essentially, what is this going to cost me? That preliminary assessment and the notification to the property owner that, look, we want to form a district and we want to do sidewalk improvements and we want to put sidewalks in front of your house, but if we do this, it's going to cost you $10,000 or $20,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is. Having that information and knowing how much the project is going to cost the individual property owner is critical in order to enable them to make a choice of whether or not to agree to form the district. And since the current statutes don't necessarily require that, this bill will place language into the statutes that requires the city either up front at the initial hearing, which is the way the city of Portland does it, or after an engineer, as city engineer, has gone out and done a preliminary analysis of the project costs and the scope of the size of the district. At either one of those two stages, depending on how each individual city does it, at one of those two stages, individual notification will go to the property owner, and the property owner in that notice will see the district, the proposed district, the size of the proposed district, what the improvements are, and how much is estimated it will cost each individual property owner. And by doing that, you give the property owner the information that they need to make the informed choice of whether or not to enter into the district. So that's, to me, that's the key component. The second thing it does, as Representative Davis indicated, is it protects the rights of the minority property owners. We solve the situation where you have one property owner that has 90% of the property in the proposed district, and nine property owners that make up the other 10% of the property in the district, with the one property owner essentially having the ability to override the nine. You might have a 9-1 vote against formation of the district, but because the one property owner with the 90% wants the district to form, it forms. The idea, and again, the hallmark of the LID process, is to give people and property owners an opportunity to vote. In a situation like that, the property owner, the nine property owners that make up the minority part of the district, really don't have the opportunity to vote. They could vote and say, we don't want this, but it doesn't really matter. It's getting crammed down their throat. So this bill addresses that, and as Representative Davis says, splits in situations where you've got one property owner that controls more than 50% of the district. It splits the vote into that property owner and then the other property owners that make up the remaining portion of the district. If the property owners in the remaining portion of the district, if there's not a majority of those people that are in favor of the district, it doesn't mean the district can't form. The bill provides that the district can form, but it simply says that those property owners in the minority that object to the formation of the district can't be assessed for part of the cost of making the improvements. So that essentially what it does is it not only guarantees that you have the right to vote, but it also guarantees that your vote counts for something. And so we've done that as well. The third thing the bill does that I don't think Representative Davis touched upon is it requires property owner to consent to have their property included in a district if the district has already been formed and the city is attempting to change the boundaries of the district to include some property. So you have a district that was formed in 2013, and now the city in 2015 decides that they want to add a little some additional property to the district. When they, if they were to do that, and that's our, that from what we heard in our work groups, that rarely happens. But if they decide they wanted to do that, they would have to get the consent of the property owners whose property they are going to add to the district, because at that point, the property owner, the property owner whose property is going to be added to the district has missed all of the procedural protections that they were entitled to had the district been properly formed initially and their property included. So we added that provision. And then the last piece, the bill would alter the burden of proof in cases that are pending that deal with LIDs where there was a substantial difference between the assessed value of the property and the amount of the LID. And the one that we can think of is the Rollins case, where you had a property at the time of the assessment, the district, at the time of the district formation, the fair market value of the property was $300,000. At the time that the work was done and the costs were calculated and the project was spread, the project costs were spread, the Rollins share of the total project cost was $6 million and change, and their assessed value of their property was $2 million and change. When you have a $2 million piece of property with a $6 million assessment, you basically have a worthless piece of property. You can't do anything with it. You're not going to pay the assessment. Rollins couldn't pay the assessment, and even if they could, only a fool would pay on a $6 million loan for a piece of property with a real market value of $2 million. So this bill, it doesn't wipe out the lawsuit that's pending right now. The Kaiser has sued to foreclose on the Rollins property. What it does is it simply changes the burden of proof and requires the city of Kaiser to demonstrate that the amount of the assessment imposed on the Rollins property is equal to the value that they received as a result of their of the improvements that were made.
So in that last section, I see we've got a sunset on that particular provision, but do we have, not being a legal beagle, do we have, it's called maybe a severability clause in case you can't do this, we don't throw out the rest of your work here?
Mr. Chair, there is a statutory severability clause for all legislation that Ledge Council.
Thank you, Legal Beagle.
That this body would pass.
Right,
that
okay.
May or may not have problems. I don't think we have a problem here, but.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Aaron, how about you tell us? You've been in the meetings.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I have been in this work group, and
it's exciting over the holidays.
Oh, you know, there's nothing like ignoring all of your friends on New Year's Eve to read through some LID statute in California.
okay.
Great excitement.
Dream come true.
I like
he's like, I loved it.
I like Rep. Davis, you know, put the LID statutes on my wall as a small child. No, I'm kidding, of course. We have done some analysis, and as we've worked through the work group, I've come back to my cities because there's 242 cities, and that means there's at least 500 opinions on how LID should and shouldn't work and what the sideboards are. And we, most of my cities have come back at this point and expressed deep-seated concerns about not the notice portion of this, but about the this subsection 1, subsection 6, opt-out provisions or the remonstrance provisions. The majority of the cities that I have information from, we did a very brief poll of some cities that have done this, used this tool in the last 10 years. The majority of them have a two-thirds remonstrance requirement. So a 50% is a significant change in policy for them. They have gone through a public process and they've come to the political conclusion that two-thirds is appropriate for their communities, and it worked. They haven't faced the Rollins situation. Most of them are sitting in, you know, that have LIDs, have been able to work through the LIDs and haven't ended up in quite the level of controversy that has surrounded the Kaiser and Kaiser Station development. And I think some of that is because, you know, the last time they did it was, you know, 2003, so they've fallen that 10 years. But the economy didn't tank in the meantime. So that's their, that is allowing the cities to have used this tool and to use this effectively and allowing them to set their remonstrance levels. They've opted for two-thirds, and it's worked in their communities, and that's what they continue to move forward with. I would also point out that most of them have said, while we have two, or not most of them, some of them have said, while we have a two-thirds remonstrance requirement, anything that's around 50% will lead the city council to have a political conversation and make a decision based on their local community's needs and the urgency with which this LID needs to be formed. And they are not going to go out and try and ram this down the throats unless it is a health and safety or a brownfields or an underdevelopment and a way to spur economic development that is just has a price tag that some folks aren't comfortable with. And by making those decisions at the local level, they have a read of the economic value of a district, and they have a read of the true nature of what the LID can provide the city and the long-term benefits of that. Similarly, in the 50%, when there's a 50% plus owner, percentage owner, like the 80-20 is what we've referred to it as, there's even more concern that there is a bit of undemocratic fairness in cutting out that large property owner's value and investment in that property by basically saying, okay, you've approved it, your vote goes over there in the corner, and now the rest of you remaining, maybe you only have 2% of the total assessment going forward, but you can put a stop to the LID, regardless of the benefits it might your property might receive as a result.
Sorry, let me ask a technical question here. Can they, under the proposal, can they put a stop to the LID or just their participation in it?
Chair Clem, it breaks down. They could stop the formation of the LID as proposed, and then the majority property owner could come in and say, well, I'll just pick up their 2% assessment, which goes to the second concern that they have, where basically there is no disincentive for remonstrating, and it puts it all on the developer of that large piece of property to make a decision of whether or not to go forward and carry the cost of the entire local improvement district, which is an unfair economic advantage to those minority property owners because now they have no burden of paying for the benefits that their property is going to receive under the terms of the construction. Because if you need to cut across a piece of property to build a road, they can take advantage of having that road built out in front of them in a way that it can support emergency vehicles, two lanes of cars. This is especially important in commercial districts where maybe now you have truck access. They don't want to pay for it. They know they're in the minority of ownership, and thereby if they remonstrate but the developer wants to go forward with their project and is going to cover their costs, they gain the benefit and don't pay for it.
So you're worried potentially about a situation where they sort of game the system, where they actually do want the benefit, but they either figure out or get advised. If we vote no on this, they may go forward anyway, and that developer is going to pay it. So let's vote no. Even though we actually normally would vote yes and pay it, let's take a gamble here, vote no, then the developer says, I got to do it anyway, and then pays it.
Chair Holm, that's correct. That is a concern that we have. Hmm. The other potential outcome is that when we look at LIDs that are being proposed that do have a majority ownership in one single person or entity, we just don't go forward anymore. And that kind of, because the tool becomes too complicated. And it's already complicated enough that a number of our cities, in past years, the city of Salem has just opted to never use this tool because it's too much work. It's too difficult to use this tool, so that's one of four tools that's taken off the table for doing infrastructure development. And more cities see this as burdensome on the potential underdeveloped or undeveloped properties, the green fields and the, you know, I don't know what, they're not built up yet, but they're not quite green fields. So that's a concern that we've lost that economic development tool in areas that should and are set up to be urbanized. So that's where my cities have come back expressing their concerns about that particular provision. As to the provision regarding changing the boundaries after formation, I think that is a solution looking for a problem. I don't think it meant, we originally thought that in the spurring situation that that had happened, and that would be very concerning to many folks, and we could understand if that was a solution to that particular incident and driver. However, that's not what happened. And therefore, I think that section goes beyond the scope of what we were trying to do in this work group, the rifle shot at the specific examples of where things have gone wrong. And one other city has come back and said, well, there's also the concern of what if it's an additional property in that way that a property got split in half and you now have two taxing units. I'm not sure how that works out depending upon how you define the properties, given that we have a map. But, you know, there's things we need to think through before we offer a solution to a problem that doesn't appear to exist. And finally, to the section that's directed at Kaiser that changes the burden of at trial, while this is directed at a specific incident that is currently going through the litigation process, I have had a firestorm of emails about that this actually has statewide implications, because what it says to cities is, despite your best efforts, when you come in and you form this LID and you go through the local process and maybe not everybody's happy with it, in the end, if the market should crash, a developer, a property owner, someone can come to the state legislature and ask to have their burdens shifted and changed the bargain that was entered into when the LID was formed. Not only does that concern a number of cities, it also has concerned, I've had conversations with at least one bound counsel who's been working in municipal financing for 37 years, and he says, well, it wouldn't prevent bonds from being issued, it will have an impact on the interest rates charged. And if we change the interest rates charged on the bonds, we're not going to be able to afford the bonds, or we're going to have situations when the LID tool is just useless because the bonding interest rate savings don't pan out in a private loan, and the developer paying their own way through private loans and them going out to seek the loans is the only means by which we have to pay for this infrastructure. That is a concern that many cities that I've talked to statewide are facing with that particular section, and I know we're trying to drill down on a particular incident, and I believe that Kaiser also, while I shouldn't speak for Kaiser, I know that they have gone forth with litigation that they feel very strongly about as far as this foreclosure, and they're actually, I believe, in court today making arguments. So they believe that they did an assessment and an appraisal that differs significantly from the county's real market value used for tax property assessment, and that's a fundamental difference that we've had in this process, is what is the value of property? Is it what an appraiser says, or is it what the counties say? And many of my cities, while we love our counties and we love our county assessors because they do a lot of work for us, they don't necessarily come in and do individualized appraisals of individual pieces of property when it comes to establishing real market value for purposes of local improvement districts. And with that, I'm happy to answer the questions you likely have.
So we'll obviously hear a lot more about this as we get into session. There's a real bill, and we've got at least 2 weeks to keep working on these things you've just outlined, and whether some things can stay or go or be tweaked further. We're hoping there might be at least one more shot at a work group meeting, Mr. Chair, to work on these things. You know, I will say that it would be helpful, since you can't speak for Kaiser, if they would come to one of these meetings when we talk about this so we could talk to them directly.
I'm planning a meeting with them, and yeah, once again encouraging them, if not because they're concerned about the impacts on litigation they have. Yeah. You know, they, yeah. I'm going to strongly encourage them to make their case as well.
Yeah. All righty then. So any more questions about this one? Obviously, they'll be back, and we'll see if we can't get closer to allaying all the concerns before then anyway.
Sounds good.
Hope you have no other plans or anything like that for the next couple weeks. So, all righty then. Thank you for participating in the work group, both of you. And thank you to work group Chairman Davis for, as you can see, he knows a lot about this. And it's kind of sad, but I'm happy that you do and are willing to take it on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yes, that's right. Out in the hall, right? Okay. And
Oh, do you want to talk about, yes.
Yeah, could we have... Yeah.
Representative Davis has
it. It should only take 45, 50 minutes,
yeah.
Somewhere in that range.
I'm about four or five or eight.
I'm going to pass down a summary of... So on the other side of my wall growing up, opposite the LID statutes, I actually had Oregon's UGB statute. And looked forward to the day when I could insert myself into a dispute about our land use planning system. That day has come, gladly. So I'm killing two birds with one.
Dream come true. Committee.
Today is just a dream come true in my life. You know?
Living the dream.
We do our best to make this a pleasurable experience.
Thank you. I'd actually like to invite Sean Julians to come up. I didn't totally brief him, but...
He's not wearing a beaver tie. I don't think so.
But I get it for being in the room.
Yeah, that's right.
The brief summary of the situation here is Metro is tasked with analyzing the urban growth boundary in the Metro region on generally a five-year basis to determine a 20-year supply. In 2010, Metro did this based on the urban and rural reserves decision that had been made, I think, about a year previously. And there is currently a situation where, even though the UGB decision was made unanimously by Metro in 2011, was upheld by the Land Conservation and Development Commission in June 2012, that decision is currently at the Court of Appeals and has not been heard. As far as we know, will not be heard, is stayed, the process has completely stopped, and this is creating a number of issues. First, there's a process issue in if Metro is supposed to analyze the UGB every 5 years. We have a process that started in 2010, it's now January of 2014. They're supposed to make their next determination in a year, and the last determination hasn't even been finalized and is stopped completely. So there's a process question. There's also a substantive question about in these areas, this roughly 1,985 acres that were brought into the Metro UGB, there are a number of education needs, housing needs, and industrial needs. One thing that we've heard today, and I've heard continually in our Economic Development Committee, is the need for quote, shovel-ready industrial land in the state of Oregon. That includes land in these 2,000 acres. The Beaverton School District and the Hillsborough School District are planning for schools in these areas. Just for example, Beaverton has qualified, I think, every single one of their high schools as overcrowded, and they want to open a 2,000-student high school by 2017. Doors open, kids in the classroom, and they're relying on this UGB determination to do that and
already
to build that school.
They already bought land in this?
My understanding is they've purchased the land. Yeah, it is in there. And Hillsborough, although their situation is not as urgent, they are planning on schools as well. I also bring this bill because without spending a dollar, the state of Oregon can spur upwards of $400 million in development in this community in an area where residential land prices are currently higher now than they were even at the height of the boom, residential land prices. So there's a shortage of developable land for housing. And with that, I want to toss it over to Sean Jillians, who will
probably to sell some houses. And there's a guy behind him who wants to build some houses.
Exactly.
That's strange.
Hello.
Thank you. Do you want to bring your friend up with you?
Well,
if he builds them, I don't know if he'll live in it.
Yeah. Maybe you're, maybe Mr. Chandler's members could build them and not him, actually.
That's
just for our safety.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, with Tom Guitar. Actually, today, not on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors, I represent a couple of developers out in Washington County, Newland, and Metro Land Group. On this particular one, I think Representative Davis gave a great summary of it. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for being involved in this process, too. Obviously, we've been talking about this for a while. The only things I would add to the summary is we have been working with Metro and the Metro Council to try and work on how best to achieve this. I certainly won't say there's consensus there yet, but we have been very busy in trying to figure out how we can kind of get the process moving. I think the key point that Representative Davis mentioned is that the process is completely stopped. It's very different than previous UGB decisions, which you've heard me complain about repeatedly how long it takes, Mr. Chair. That usually I'm talking about things that at least have had briefs filed and or arguments scheduled, and the court is just taking a long time to determine it. This particular UGB expansion is literally stayed, and it has been so for a year, while the court grapples with the larger issue of urban and rural reserves. key point that wasn't mentioned, this bill does not take on that larger issue of urban and rural reserves. As much as we'd love to, you know, solve it all in a short February session, we're taking the more limited approach of just the small UGB expansion that was approved by Metro unanimously and acknowledged unanimously by LCDC a couple of years ago. That, happy to answer any questions. Look forward to working with you all, not only in the next couple of weeks, but February as well.
And Representative Davis, I know we talked about potentially a couple of different ways to go about it, and I don't know where we landed in this LC draft anyway. One is sort of legislatively approve almost, validate the decisions of Metro and the LCDC. Another is to do something on the court side to try and speed it up. But then we had some separation of powers discussion. Yeah. So where did we, are we still...
So there were sort of two alternatives that we discussed, one of which would have been to essentially legislatively order the Court of Appeals to make a decision, and we received a lot of pushback from legislative counsel about a separation of powers issue that would generate with...
What?
And I said, that's crazy!
That's right.
So the LC is currently drafted, and I'm actually heading down to LC after this to have some further discussions about the language in the bill. But the LC as drafted would validate the Metro process and the unanimous decision that the department came up with.
So just for committee members' benefit, I had a conversation with the governor's natural resource advisor, Richard Whitman, who was former director of the agency, and he's sort of familiar with the court case and all that kind of thing. So we're trying to engage, still even between now and then, and how could we get this moving? Because these particular places aren't particularly objected to by people for UGB expansion. There are definitely areas that are part of the urban-rural reserves that are under a heavy contesting on the substance of them. These really, from my understanding, aren't so much, but they are caught up in this other process. So we're trying to find some way to disentangle, if possible, without setting, bad precedents and things like that. We'll stay tuned. I'm trying to see if we can get something cooked up here in the next few weeks, but we needed a vehicle to work from over the last month or so, 6 weeks. And thank you for sharing. Again, this would be the time if we invited any committee members and or members to bring their bills that might end up here. We got two. If anybody's got anything else you want to share, I'm not going to talk about my annexation bill because you've all heard about it, but one of the two will be back. I'm not bringing them both back. That should excite everyone. We won't have two annexation issues. Just one. Just one little annexation issue. Anybody else got bills now? Okay, and we're finished. Adjourned.